Once I heard you use the nickname Spiritual Redneck to describe yourself. What's the story behind the name, and do you own it?
My son Luca owns it. Yeah, he absolutely, to my knowledge, came up with that phrase. We were talking about some pals of mine, among them Jeffrey Folkalt, who listeners probably know from his wonderful music, and David Duncan as well, and a couple of other pals, a guy named Jimmy Watts from Bellingham, who is an incredible bamboo rod maker, but also the kind of green beret of firefighters in downtown Seattle. When he's not saving elderly women from burning houses or helping women give birth to babies in the back of a fire engine, he's down diving, looking for, I don't know, bombs or lost people or whatever they look for in the sound there. And another pal, Brett Simmons, we have this long email chain that basically Luca got a hold of one day, and he said, "Dad, you know what you guys are, right?" And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "You're spiritual rednecks."
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Chris Dombrowski about his collection of poems, Ragged Anthem. Stay with us. This book begins with an address and a confrontation. In the first poem, Gentle Reader, you write about the speaker looking through the rented room's peephole. And the line is, "We stood there, eye to glass shrunk eye, until one of us thought he saw the other's anger flinch." What's the anger that this book is circling?
This book was composed over a pretty odd period of time. Some of the poems were composed way back in the 2008, 2009, 2007 era. That's not really an era, but you get what I mean. And then others between 2013 and 2011 and 2013, and then others later in the game, closer to the publication date. I feel that this book is trying to come to terms with some of what I would call the latent or understory of anger that is present in our country right now. A lot of the poems I thought were old, right? But I had composed them during another time where I seemed to have kind of put a bead on or touched the pulse of this anger. And then suddenly here we were again.
One of your poems, which is pulled from a song title, Hold Me Closer, Tiny Dancer, you write, "You are a Caucasian American male, at fault for most of your nation's failings. At least you can smother your already smothered guilt with calories." And I wanted to ask you, how are you trying or meaning to include us or repulse us or inspire us or arouse us or punish us with this collection?
Ooh, I think any poet would aspire to his or her poems doing any one of the things you just mentioned, right? I don't believe that poetry should always nurture us. You know, it's okay for poetry to disenchant us, if you will. When we're over-enchanted, we can miss what's going on out there, right? I think often of this philosopher, I've heard him referred to as a post-Jungian philosopher, James Hillman. I've heard him referred to as a few other things, but post-Jungian is the one I hear often. And he talks about the difference between spirit, which tends to want to ascend out of difficulty, and soul, which he says is found in the kind of darker vale or valley, if you will. He actually attributes the former. He says men are good at going up and down. It's a phallic thing, right? But women are much more capable of remaining in the kind of the darkness and the depths, you know, maybe what Keats would have called negative capability. So I think, you know, right now we're happy to, I don't like to make generalizations, but we seem happy as a nation to just escape what's really going on.
Moving into an interior space of the domestic, the book is dedicated to your wife and children. And I was wondering if you would start by reading Cooking Christmas Dinner with My Son, the Runner.
Sure, I'd love to. Cooking Christmas Dinner with My Son, the Runner. I batter the halibut I traded elk steaks for, drip leftover egg into the pan, scrambling a present I slide into the dog's steel bowl. Brussels halved and oiled, I let loudly fall into a skillet congealed with bacon grease. In the garage, curing hangs yesterday's harvest, a pheasant from which I ask Luca to carve four portions with the knife he unwrapped today. Just breasts and legs, we'll skin the rest tomorrow, make stock for soup. I stir as the setter that pointed the bird in Russian olives, fetched it from cattails, sits tall, sloppily licking his chops before splashing elegantly to the opening door where Luca proffers the meat. Dad, he says, staring at two pink breasts on the cold white plate. I'm sorry, but as a runner, I will not cut the legs from another animal. A teaching, I reckon, popping a hot Brussels into my mouth, chewing, releasing the steam that must be pursued far beyond the limits of pursuit.
In whose tradition are you writing about the domestic? And what's the conversation you're having with yourself maybe about fathering?
I think that notion of the paternal is very much at work in this book. I think Earth Again, for better or worse, attempted to engage with the maternal, you know, with the goddess. And this book tries to embrace the paternal, you know, which at this point in this century and moment of mania, to steal a phrase from Robert Penn Warren, is very much at the forefront, right? So the domestic is a way of engaging a little bit more deeply with reality, not using poetry as an escape from daily life, but as a way deeper in, if you will. I can't remember who says it, some Buddhist teacher, maybe it was Thich Nhat Hanh, maybe he was pulling it from an older philosopher, but he says basically, it's hardest to practice the way at home. You know, it's easy to be meditative and to be transcendent if you're walking in the woods for 10 to 12 hours a day. But when you come back home, it suddenly puts your beginner's mind to task again. Another friend of mine used to say, there's nothing like a little Zen talk to get you a kick in the butt, you know? And I feel that way. I think these poems try to engage with the muck of daily life a little bit more than my previous books do.
This word muck brings to mind what you're dredging up. You blur the lines between history and here and now. And I wanted to know, yeah, what are you grappling with from the earlier years of your life? Or
I'm not sure even that the earlier years of my life are where the dredging stops. I think we keep going back and back and back. So I don't know that the dredging stops at my own life, but I hope it looks further and further back through history, because we know enough about time now to know that it's not it doesn't exist on the kind of timelines they gave us in elementary school, you know.
I realize I don't think I meant to suggest something so personal, because you I mean, there is big cosmology and God is referenced in this book. And yet in your work, I was struck by the level of naming, of just you have people's names throughout. And Liz Charles comes back.
Yeah.
And I am dying to know Liz Charles.
Yes, yes. Okay, I'm with you now. Right. Throughout the first section of the book, there's a naming of these people from my past who met awful ends. And also, I think, engaging with my father's own difficulties. He grew up in a broken home with a father who abandoned the family and was a drunk's drunk, you know? And I think that's kind of the biological father that we engage with, I hope the book moves out of that into the kind of mythical or cosmological, as you say. But yeah, back to Liz, back to these people from my youth who met difficult ends. I remember a Czesław Miłosz poem. I can't remember which poem it is, but he essentially goes into this long litany of his people who died in the war or met tragic ends. He says he empowers their memory by naming them. And so I felt, whereas I don't want to sound confessional in these poems, I felt that it would be a disservice to muddle the person or the name, right, that was associated with the events.
Yeah. Will you read a few sections from the long poem, Going Home?
Sure, I will. You know, we mentioned Jeffrey earlier. Jeffrey and I have fiddled around with this one. He has a new slide guitar he's fond of, and so we've been trying to record a reading of this with acoustic accompaniment, if you will. You can't cry in a river. At least, they can't prove you did. Autopsy said they drowned him before they sawed his neck from his torso. Separate bags, black and zipped and cast like jitterbugs, we raked across those eddies. Crawdads worrying at his whitened skin about the time the newspaper reported he'd gotten in over his head. I only played JV with him, Frenched his sister when she relented, but reckon he wouldn't have shed a tear, not a drop that would have added to the current's push. What is it in me, or who, insists that proverbially rowing across the river is somehow richer than a sprig of mint broken near my nose, more alluring than a sandy mouthful of cress, or my son descending the switchbacks with his headlamp on. That river. Two black wolves crossed the boulder below a bend I fished, shook dry, then flowed up the tawny side hill and loped down country, calling through a warm fall wind to one another or to others on the far bank they could not see. Two black wolves. I heard their musculature resist the water, then saw sunlight bristling off their coats. In this world, it came to pass. Did you ever see a wolf, Leon Ward Stockwood? My dear Liz Charles, into whose skull surgeons sawed? Asa Bromley clutching at the wheel as your Suburban rolls over in Iowa. A gymnasium full of crying teens. The basketball team sitting arm in arm. Leon whispering to me, he's gone. No goddamn song will bring him back.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Chris Dombrowski about his collection of poetry, Ragged Anthem. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast.
That line, "You can't cry in a river, at least they can't prove you did." I was caught by that, wondering about the hidden forms of pain or pain's erasure, like tears in a river. What can you say about that?
Yeah, that's actually a line I stole from another poem of mine. I was enduring a long period of time, I'd say a fairly rough time in Michigan, and among other things, this, in addition to being broke and homesick for Montana, I think I was struggling through the writing of a new book, and I took a nap with a map of the Lake Michigan coastline over my head because I was trying to, it was a midday nap and it was bright out and I needed to block out the light. So I put this atlas over my head and it happened to be a section of the map that had a bunch of lake on it. And I, in the dream that I had with this atlas over my head, I had begun to cry. And so the image of that found its way into a poem and I thought about how the water, in a sense, absorbed that suffering or that expression, if you will.
And I know in the acknowledgments and at your book release in Missoula, Montana, you talk about deliverance. What does it mean to you to be delivered?
I mean, I really think this book attempts to wrestle with some difficult phases, not only in my own life, but in our history, right? And I do quote an old friend in the acknowledgments of the book who says about a poem of his own, "This is a record of deliverance, which is always near, but quite often invisible," or something to that effect. I feel like the poems and the book itself can answer that a lot more astutely and articulately than I can. But what this old friend was saying when he coined that phrase was that when you're in it, that being the opposite of deliverance, you can't ever see your way out of it, right? Whether it's depression or delusion. But when you're out of it, you're out of it, right? So I think that's what it means. It means to not be in it anymore, but you can't disappear or teleport out of it. The muck has to be worked through, right? You know, and that's back to Hillman. That's what he's saying. There's no leaping out of it through spirit. It has to be ground out through something that's a lot more difficult to attain. I'm not sure how I feel about memoir as a genre in nonfiction, but I do think that poems give us the opportunity or demand that we wrestle with the most difficult subject matter that we can and say, I think, to steal another phrase from Milosh, what's worst yet true. Poetry, you know, poetry is it's a singer with a guitar on stage, maybe minus the guitar, right? Acoustic.
And in the book, you pull lines and titles from Tom Waits, Mason Jennings, Elton John, Christian Mattson, a.k.a. the Talisman on Earth.
Yeah.
And so tell me, what does song do for you?
Ooh, man. Song is transportive. You know, song, if we're talking about deliverance, I think songs can deliver us out of mindsets probably better than anything, really. And that poem that references the line from The Tallest Man on Earth is really, I think, a poem about deliverance. And it comes at a moment in the book. The first two sections are over, and the roughest subject matter has been dealt with. And the poem's title is Poem in Which I Lose My Wish to Drown. The Tallest Man on Earth's line is, I lose my wish to drown. It's in a song off of, I think, his first or second album. The speaker of the poem, who is very close to me, the autobiographical I in this sense, the speaker of the poem is alone out on a sheer flat Lake Michigan, and a fish comes to the boat. In that moment, he has this realization. He's boated this fish and he's cleaned it or begun to clean it, and the fish's roe spills out onto the white floor of the boat. And he is struck by this ghostly sensation that the painter Mark Rothko is wanting to inhabit his body, to engage with this beautiful shade of orange that has spilled onto the canvas of this boat floor. In so doing, the speaker realizes that he is alive, that he is here grasping this tangible world, right? And that Rothko, God that he is, right, for his incredible art, does not have this. And so the speaker has this epiphany, if you will, at the end of the poem where he says, I lord it over him and the gone. That is, I think, a poem about deliverance, about being transported from a very desperate state of mind. And again, it's like a switch, right? You were there and then you're not any longer. I think that poem probably answers your question about deliverance better than I can with words today.
In your other life, you row people down rivers, which to me brings to mind the mythology of the ferryman. What are you rowing across in your writing?
You're only the second person who has ever posed that very obvious question to me. I can't believe that it hadn't struck me as somehow ironic or apropos, you know, particularly with in my early poems. I think I wanted to write from, quote, the grave as often as possible, you know, but we talked about that a little bit the other night with regard to Robert Hass, who says it's not healthy to live with an elegiac view of the world, right? And so the myth of rowing across the river is addressed early in the book as you asked me to read the section from Going Home. And I don't know that I think about it very often when I'm on the river guiding. In fact, it struck me the other day that I don't regard the trout as a mythical creature very often, or a fish, despite the fact that I'm a Pisces. You know, I'm maybe this whole time I've just been pursuing myself, but that just dawned on me after 21 years of rowing boats. So there's a level of practicality and immediacy and engagement that guiding demands that doesn't really allow one to reflect on it in kind of a mythological way. But then, of course, when I step back to the desk in late fall or winter, I'm allowed to think about it. I don't really know that I have an answer other than to say that a poem can be viewed as a raft or a boat or a craft that somehow transports the reader and or the speaker of the poem from one shore to another, you know, and that shore can be grieving, it can be anger, it can be disillusionment, it can be boredom or whatever. It can be boredom to the shore of attention, it can be grief to the shore of joy, or disillusionment to enlightenment. But either way, some transportation has to take place for a poem to be a poem. And so, if anything, in this book, I think I attempted to meet as many speakers as I could at their darkest moment, you know, and then hope that the poem would exist as a vehicle or a craft to take them to the other shore.
Will you just finish by reading Tablet?
Sure. Okay, yeah, cool. I'd love to read that poem. So I wrote this poem in October of probably 2012. I had, through the graciousness of a client, been flown back to Missoula to guide he and his daughter for a couple of days in the fall in on our annual trip, which I wasn't going to be able to take part in because I was teaching in Michigan. And I was at a little bit of an impasse with my job in Michigan, and I had to decide very quickly whether or not I was going to stay in the teaching position or whether I was going to come back to Montana, from which I was extremely homesick. We spent a few wonderful, rich days on the river in October, which are, you know, the best days we get each year. I had to wake up early and get to the plane, and woke up with this line in my head. So back to that idea of a poem being a craft or a boat that helps transport the speaker or the reader from one shore to another. This was a poem for me that was essentially a poem that transported me from homesickness to home, if you will. So, Tablet. To obey, wake in the dark and put your head in your hands. Look out the window and rest your cheek on the shoulder of the mountain. Rise and walk to where the creek falls finally into the river. There, an apple tree stands hung with one last fruit. Pick it, or if it hangs too high, knock it down with a branch and eat it in three juice-spilling bites. From your knees, kiss the rill surrounded by forget-me-nots. Beckon a brook trout to your hands. And if one arrives, study the vermiculate script worming along its sides. Over a stick fire, cook the fish until its skin pales and peels back from the orange flesh. Then feed yourself. Clean every last silver rib and feed the skin and dead-eyed head to the mass of ants on their moving hill. Into the small boat of those remaining bones, fold yourself, then row.
Chris Dombrowski writes, teaches, and guides in Western Montana. He's the author of three poetry collections, as well as an acclaimed nonfiction debut, Body of Water. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.